Welcome to Entrepreneur Eats, a conversation about business and community with a side of eats. My name is Deanna Smith, and I'm your host. Hello, this is Deanna Smith, and I am your host for Entrepreneur Eats, and I have a very special guest today, Ms. Kay Bates. It's an honor for you to be here. I am so excited because you are a spectacular, strong, successful, brilliant, gorgeous woman. Kay Bates, how are you today?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be a guest on your podcast. And I'm doing great. I'm fired up and ready to go, as they say. I am originally from Trinidad and Tobago, which most people always are like, is that where Jamaica is? Trinidad and Tobago, just twin islands, 6 miles outside Caracas, Venezuela. We're pretty much South Americans. My daughter was just telling me, she goes, I think we're considered Latinos. I said, I don't know. I mean, even though they speak Spanish, English, and French. Mm-hmm. English is their first language. But we're definitely we're like under a little hoof. So Trinidad and Tobago was also part of Venezuela. And I don't know how many umpteens of centuries ago, there was, I guess, some huge storm and it broke off. And it's Trinidad and Tobago. So mm-hmm. It is very Latin. So I'm very proud to be up there. No matter how long I've been here, in my heart, I'll always be from Trinidad and Tobago. I love it there. I love the people. Our culture is different to the American culture. When I was raised there and when I went to school, things were definitely different. We had one channel that we could watch on TV. Well, we had two channels, but they both showed the same shows. It just depended on where you live so you could get a better reception. But it was only one channel. So needless to say, I was raised in a very strict household because, I mean, you were monitored. We didn't have where you have a big living room and there was one TV. We did have color TV and we had all that stuff. We had stuff because we had a lot of friends who lived in America and we had friends who lived in Colombia and they would traffic stuff home and bring stuff back and take stuff back to the States and to Colombia as well. But we did have a very strict guideline. My mom was, you know, we had supper at a certain time. We didn't have big lunches or big breakfast, but we had like supper, and supper was usually earlier than how we eat here now. And so it was such a different lifestyle. Education was always first. Like, you have to do well. You have to finish school. You have to graduate. You must go to college. You must be somebody, even though we're a third world country, right? And people think that education isn't the thing that people stress upon. But my mom, we called my mom Ayatollah Khomeini. That's how strict. That's how strict our household was. We're like, Ayatollah Khomeini is going to come and get you. Oh, yeah. We were like, she is so strict. But then it's understanding like where she came from, mm-hmm. that why she wanted us to succeed and do so well. And today we all live here and everybody's pretty successful. Mm-hmm. Everybody's doing well. And that's my brothers and my sister. They're all doing well.
Yeah, great structure.
So, yeah, we came to the United States through Puerto Rico. My mom and my aunt's twins and my uncle, my aunt's husband, got an offer to come and run Hess Oil St. Croix. And my aunt, we were all living together. We had periods of times where all four kids and two mom and dads all lived together. And anybody can spank you. Anybody can discipline you. And at the same time, anybody can pick you up, give you a hug, give you that love that you might need on that day. Mm-hmm. And my aunt said, well, she couldn't go without her sister. So that offer has to be for two families, not for one family. And so they agreed. They had my aunt and her husband and her kids move there first. They like rushed their green cards and then they applied for their citizenship. I mean, everything was done like within a year. And then we were next in 1981, we moved to St. Croix. So we all went through Puerto Rico and we got our green cards and we went to St. Croix. And while we lived there, I mean, I was already done with college because I was going to college while I was going to high school. However, once we got to St. Croix, there wasn't really much for me to do. And it is very tiny. I think it's 84 square miles. You know, I have bigger visions. Mm-hmm. And I left and I went to New York.
How old were you when you went to New York?
19.
Oh, my goodness.
At that time, two of my aunts lived in New York. And so I told my one aunt, I'm like, can I come stay with you? Because I just want to see like what New York, we hear all this stuff about New York, but I've never been there. So I'm like, let's just go to New York. And they're like, okay, you go to New York and we're going to think about it, but we're going to San Diego because your cousin is in the service and he's at Camp Pendleton. So we're going to go to San Diego. And I said, okay. So I have a passion for designing, fashion design, and I decided I was going to go to Parsons School of Design. But as soon as I signed up and I got admitted, I got pregnant. Needless to say, it didn't work out. Yes, so I eventually had to backtrack, didn't do any of that. But then I traveled a lot. So the guy that I was with, my daughter's father, he had a business, and it was a very successful business. I mean, he would buy stuff. We would shop in New York, shop in a couple other different states, and take it back to Trinidad. We had some great connections, but it was a very lucrative business. So it was a entrepreneurship from a very young age. I got introduced into, hey, being your own boss, doing things, doing it right. You know, if it doesn't work out once, don't give up. Just continue working hard. It's going to pay off. And eventually I got a little worn out. It was like, I need something more. And I said, okay, I'm going to go visit California. I came out here and I hated it. It's like, this is slow. There's no bus. There's no train. Why do y'all live out here? 2 weeks later, I was back in New York. I was back into the hustle, back into the grind, back shopping. And after about 6 months, I was like, I think I got to go back. And
California, I came back. California was looking pretty good by then.
It was looking, because I was like, I'm in the same rat race. I'm doing the same thing that I was complaining about. And so I packed up my bags, packed my daughter up, and I came out here. And that's all she wrote. There's so much that I've done. My resume looks like a carnival.
And that's what creates amazing entrepreneurs.
Well, that's exactly it. I would say probably, yeah, the trials and error. And I tried a lot of stuff. I mean, when I first came out here and I decided I was going to stay, we all lived in Penasquitos. And my one cousin was like, let us get a place. You have a daughter. No sense. You know, my mom's house was smaller. So I said, okay, let's do that. And I decided, I was like, you know what? Do you mind if I like bake? And he was like, you're going to bake and do what? I was like, I'm going to bake and sell them. I mean, I made cakes and people were coming to pick them up at nighttime. And he's like, are you selling drugs at my house? Like, no, just cakes. I mean, I bake cakes now because it's definitely a passion. But I've learned to understand that baking helps relax me. That's why I like it so much.
Yes, it's methodical. It's very science, and you have to pay attention.
I can't be on the phone. I can't watch a show. I can't talk to anybody else.
I'm in the
kitchen and I am in a zen mode. It's like, this is all I can pay attention to. And I think that's why I love it so much. And so I still bake today. And my baking is absolutely amazing. And it's gluten-free.
Yay!
So it's not that it's healthier, but it's better for me and my gut, you know. But I also I don't know if you remember back in the early 90s, they had those crochet baskets you would put your pots in. So I would make those and I sold them. And this was while I was going to cosmetology school. Because I'm like, you gotta, I mean, I came with an entrepreneurial spirit. I was like, I'm ready to move and shake and do something. And San Diego is slow. So I was like, we gotta create some energy here. My cousin looked at me and he goes, you're moving way too fast for all of this that's going on. Just finish your school and see what else happens. And I thought,
that's not possible.
That's not possible. Mm-mm. So I went to school, I got done, and then I took a job at Fantastic Sam's. They were cutting one person's hair like in an hour. I would do 25 heads a day. I'm like, you're supposed to move people through your chair. Like, why sit and chat? But it's the whole California thing. Everybody's a little bit slower. They enjoy like the weather and everything seems so nice. And eventually it started wearing on me and I was like, okay, maybe I should slow down. But I don't want to slow down too much. I just want a good balance. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard finding a balance. And then it got really crazy because then I got an offer to be a flight attendant. And I'd always wanted to be a flight attendant. And when I was 17, I got a job with British Airways. Mm-hmm. And my mom told me that no child of hers would ever be a flying waitress. Mm. And I was like, I can't believe I can't be a flight attendant. And so when I got this opportunity, she said, you know what? I was very wrong. I was disrespectful. I would watch your daughter while you go off and do you. Be that flight attendant. And so I did that with Eastern Airlines. In hindsight, it was so reckless. I mean, there are people that are married. There are a lot of single people. But I think I was so caught up in the job and what, I mean, back then, flight attendants were like sky goddesses. And that's what they told you. Like going through the training, they're like, you have to walk a certain way. Your uniform must always look amazing. You can't weigh more than 120 pounds. You've got to be pulling the suitcase. There's a stride that when you walk through the airport, you should always look a certain way. And I took that seriously. I mean, I enjoyed every minute of it. I mean, we were always meeting. You'd meet producers and movie stars and athletes. And I mean, there was so much going on that you couldn't help not be a part of that lifestyle. And I was roommating with a flight attendant from Delta. And so we would go out. We knew people like the Humpty Hump guys, a couple of the football players who owned bars and restaurants. And she lived in Atlanta, so we would just get into places. And I thought, how on earth could somebody live this lifestyle and not ever come up for air? Like, we could just do this all. We would get on planes. We would go to Chicago for lunch, come back. If we were off, let's go down to Louisiana. Anywhere, it was pretty much just you hop on a flight and you're gone, which flying is so different today. I mean, the lifestyle isn't the same. I have a couple of friends who were flying and they've resigned because it's so different now. Because now it's, I mean, you were still there for security reasons. Now there's a lot more regulations, and which is probably better. There's, you know, you're there for safety and you should be alert. You should be paying attention. You know, you should be really sober, which now they've put things like that in place. So the whole essence of what I enjoyed is totally different now, but I'm glad I had a chance to experience that. So I definitely could say that I had a wild side at one time in my life, but that was it. Nothing crazy, just partying, the best restaurants. Oh my God, you could eat at any restaurant in Chicago at any time of the day. It's just the lifestyle that it offered was amazing.
That sounds amazing.
It was so amazing. What
and
did I do?
Probably
after
the
that?
Best part of it is you learned true people, like their their like idiosyncrasies and their habits and their when their inhibitions are down and they're just the regular people.
They're regular people. I think that was the biggest thing. So I met the guy from Sanford and Sons, the guy who played the son. And I believe when I met him, he was a pastor. And it was so eye-opening for me because just hearing, you think you're meeting Lamont, right, from Sanford and Sons. But here he is, a pastor, and he's like, yeah, that was a role like many, many years ago. And it's good to know that people recognize me. I'm like, how could they not recognize you? You look exactly the same. But yeah, just understanding that he was human, that he felt that his role served a certain purpose, and now he has a role that he feels served more purpose than being on a TV show, you know. So it was just, yeah, it's very interesting, like you said, that you meet these people and that they're regular people, you know, and we put this clout on people to make them feel they have to live up to these glorious names and, you know, the challenges that we're going through. We're like, they're our saviors when they're really not. They're regular people. After being a flight attendant and Eastern went out of business, I was depressed for at least 6 months to a year. I came home. I just couldn't get over the lifestyle. I was so caught up on it.
You were more than on top of the world every day.
Every day. Work, and right? So I came off that plane when Eastern, our last flight out, I flew into LA and I bawled the whole drive all the way to San Diego. And I was in a serious depression.
Your heart was broken.
I am so broken. What do I do now? My mom was like, you're going to get up and find a job. That's what you're going to do. I don't want to work a job. I hate jobs. Well, you got to pay your bills. You're living somewhere. It's like, oh my gosh, I got to find a job. I don't want to work a job. But I'll tell you, I got a job as an accountant at Hunter Douglas. That was my second accounting job. The first accounting job I had in Trinidad for the government, but this was like a real accounting job in a country I wasn't familiar with. And it was definitely eye-opening. It taught me so much. I was only there for 2 years. But what these people did before, like anybody who worked there, CEO to the person who's cleaning the kitchen, has to go through their factory. You must understand what their products are. And I thought that was amazing. And I think some of that I use today. I really believe you must be intimate with what you're selling to be able to explain it to other people. And even though I wasn't selling blinds, I was not working in a factory. I wasn't doing any of their sales pitch. I wasn't putting any projects together for them. I wasn't doing any, you know, none of the work itself with the blind, but they wanted you to touch it and feel it and smell it so that when you're doing their books, you're able, if somebody made a mistake, you're able to point it out. You're able to see, hey, this couldn't have been the price for that blind because it was a 2-inch blind, right? Even today, I know how to hang blinds, inside mount, outside mount. I mean, it's amazing the stuff that they made us do. And that owner, I gave him so much credit for really understanding his product and understanding the connection, the human connection between selling what you have versus just a salesperson talking about something that they've never touched.
Sure.
Yeah, so it was really a good experience. However, I got snatched away from there to a real estate firm in La Jolla. And that's really where my real estate career started. I worked for GMS Realty, first Capital Growth Properties, CGP, in La Jolla. And the owner had seeked me out. And I'd say I worked there for 6 years. I got pregnant with my son. And this man loved me so much. He told me, you work Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and bring your son in here on the weekends with you so that nobody else has to watch your son. And then the 2 days that you work in the office, you get somebody to watch him, your husband or whoever, and then you're off the rest of the week. And I thought, you would do that for me? And he goes, absolutely. And every day I want you to come into my office. And I didn't understand why. I'm like, why? Like, we have a room of accountants. There's like 5 accountants in the room. I'm like, do you guys go and report to him every day? And they're like, no. Like, why does he make you do that? I have no idea. Like, why would he make me do this? And he would just stress, know your business well. Treat people well. Before somebody can ask for something, give it to them. I'm like, why are you telling? What am I training for? I'm an accountant. I'm doing your books. I know my numbers. He goes, I know you know your numbers. He goes, but know them well. Like, if I was to close this book, tell me what the balance was in this account. And I did. I named my son Gerard after Gerard Avenue in La Jolla because that was one of my projects. And I said, I know exactly what the balance is in Gerard Avenue. He goes, okay, what's the balance in Fay? And I told him, he goes, oh, you do know your numbers. I said, yeah, so why do you have me in here? He goes, I think you can do more. And I said, more? We have 5 accountants. What more do you want me to do? And he goes, no, I want you, you know, you have a manager and there's an assistant manager, but maybe you can grow. And I said, I don't think I want to grow anymore. I like what I'm doing and I'm very comfortable and I feel I know my craft.
So he saw something in you. You had no idea.
That's exactly what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you were about to find out.
That's why I think today, like all of these little lessons I've had was positioning me for what I'm doing now. And I only left there because, my gosh, if you guys know downtown La Jolla, there's no parking. Mm-hmm. We would have, I mean, there were probably 15 of us that worked at the office. The owner rented out all of the parking lots that he had to other people who worked in La Jolla, not to us who worked there, not even for himself. We all had to move our car every 2 hours because the meter maids came out.
It sounds like Grand Avenue.
Exactly. And it was so crazy. And I thought, okay, we can't do this anymore. Between that and getting late to pick up my son, I was like, okay, I got to change. And I went to Barone Galasso & Associates, and there I was the controller. Downtown, I don't know if you know the One America Plaza, that building. We were on the 34th floor. I have my own office, 360-degree glass building. Our suite was glass. And I thought, oh my God, this is like living on top of the world. Like, it was probably the best job. They did construction real estate. So they had, like, they're responsible for Rancho Carrillo. They're also responsible for the Boys and Girls Club downtown. There's like tons of Cafe Italia in Little Italy. Jim Barone owned that. And they were just like, no, you're in charge. You tell us. I said, no, I'm learning because I know nothing about cost accounting. At that time, I have never done anything construction. And so I got to learn loan draws, cost accounting, what really goes into it. How does the escrow hold back money to give you funds so you can do the work you're going to do? And where does the money come from? And how do you get reimbursement? And so it was definitely an eye-opening, and I enjoyed it until I just couldn't drive to San Diego anymore. Downtown San Diego was almost worse, even though we had parking, but it was almost worse than going to La Jolla every day because the traffic coming home, I mean, it's not like it is today, but it was just bad. And so I decided, I was like, okay, I don't care what they're paying me. I'm going to find a job in North County. And I went to GMS Realty, and that day I was controlling the interview, and I just asked her, should I show up Monday? And what should I wear? Like, is it business casual? Is it professional? Like, how do I dress? And she said, well, I guess you took the job. I said, yeah, I'm taking the job. Mm-hmm. And my salary, so I started probably at half of what I was making because I just so needed to get out from downtown. And in a matter of 6 months, I was making what I was making downtown. But not only that, so, you know, Bill Walton, okay, he passed last year. So his brother, Bruce Walton, was a Dallas football player. And most people, like in our office, most people didn't know him. Him and the owner, Bill Garrity, were very tight. And they would call me in their office the same thing, like with John McKelson. I'm like, why are you calling me in the office? I have a boss and she has a boss. And he goes, no, I think you should start training all the property managers. And I'm like, why me? Like, why can't my boss do that? And Bruce Walton would always be, he goes, girl, you got it. You should be doing all of this. And I said, I am not the boss around here. They're like, well, you're our boss. So you're training. And I've been to, Bruce would have parties at his house and he would embarrass me. I mean, he had even like local bands because, you know, they're pretty wealthy and they have all the means to have people like that at their homes. And I would bring like my ex-husband with me at the time. And he would say stuff that was so embarrassing. He's like, dude, you don't know. Your wife is a killer. I'm like, why are you saying stuff like that? Like, are you drunk? He goes, no, I want people to know that they should know you. I said, at your party? He goes, there's a lot of influential people here. You better start shaking hands and, you know, and taking numbers. Mm-hmm. And I said, it's not my style. I'm like more reserved. I don't really want anybody to know me. And he would have another party and he would do the same thing. And I thought, this guy is crazy. So I finally told Bill, I said, I don't ever want to go to any more of Bruce's parties. And he goes, well, you have to go. So I don't even, like, what is the lesson here? You know, I know they were trying to get me out of my shell because I'm very introverted. And so going to his parties, he felt it was safe and I had a safe space where I could open up to people and talk. He goes, you know so much. Like, come to the parties and talk. Let people know who you are. And I'm like,
so again,
what?
In your life, somebody sees something spectacular in you.
Yeah. And I'm like, why are they seeing something? I'm only this little person. I can't even do anything. I don't have any powers. But then I finally got what Bill Garrity was talking about. So I did take on the classes. I started training all the property managers. And then that wasn't enough. I mean, my salary like quadrupled in a year and a half. He's like, no, we're going to give you your flowers. Like, now, we'll pay you because you're doing. We had Hilden Kimpis, Line and Kelly as attorneys on our staff. And he goes, can you start doing lease interpretation? And then we could get rid of. I said, I'm not an attorney. I'm an accountant. And he goes, oh, don't worry about it. I think you got it. Just sit with Hilden Kimpis, Line and Kelly. And they had Jennifer Kelly at the time. And she was like, no, you could do this. I said, but we still have you on retainer because I don't want to be making any mistakes. She goes, it's just the leases you're reviewing. It's not like you're making any legal judgment. I said, okay, I'll do it. So I did that and then worked with Ernst & Young. So he wanted, we had budgets that were probably 600-page budgets. The portfolio they had was about $318 billion in assets. And I had Seaport Village, Fallbrook Plaza, the Felicita Center, where Major Market is. Major Market, how they got their name? We would advertise Major Market coming soon. So it was a Major Market coming soon. And they were in our plaza first. The very first one was Fallbrook. And so they were like, well, what's going to be the name of the market? And we were like, we don't know. And then they came up and they said, we're going to go with Major Market. And I think I had a couple of, I had like 15, my portfolio was like 15 to 18 million in my portfolio. So I did my work. Plus I would do the budget, but I did the budgets for all of the accountants. So that's why I like doing budgets. I mean, they're intricate, but I love the numbers. So I would do that. And I would work with Ernst & Young to make sure like our budgets were good and our tax stuff, because we set our tax stuff up the year before for that following year. So I made sure all that was done. And eventually they were like, okay, now you got to do one more thing. And I was like, what? Get your real estate license. And I'm like, why? Now I don't want to get my real estate license because I'm not a salesperson. And they're like, well, you just hang your license here. And if any of the leasing agents get called out and they're not here, you could go and, you know, you already know all the managers. You could probably just lease the spot. So I got the license and I hung it there in 2002. And in 2004, I was like, I think I want to serve humans, because commercial is all corporations. No emotions. There's no, whether they win or lose, nobody cares. Where we'd go to centers and look and see like how they treated their customers, the people, the consumers who came to the shopping center. And then we would look at what we did in our shopping centers. Like if people go over to Felicita, does it look clean? Is it inviting? Are the tenants open and receptive to having buyers come in? You know, how, what is the experience like? So we would do that as well. And I was like, I think it's time for me to go and work with regular people, because I want it to be impactful. I want to leave an imprint on other people instead of these corporations. Nobody cares. They don't know who you are. There's no emotion. There's no, at the end of the day, wow, that person accomplished something. Yeah, I got a bigger paycheck. I feel, you know, I earned it. You gave me more. They paid you a ton of money. But there's really no satisfaction. And so I decided, and they were bummed. I have a letter today hanging on my wall from Mr. Garrity. It was, I will take it to me wherever I go. He was like, you're probably the one person that I will meet that I would say that I will have lunch with if they would ask me. And so I left off into a world that I'd never experienced, because I'm not sales. Like I've never sold a house. The only thing I've sold was cakes and those like plant holders. I think they were plant holders. That's the only thing I've ever sold. And I didn't solicit people. I would do here at home and people would say, did you just bake that cake? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, do you want to buy it? Because I'd sell it to you. And they would buy it. That's how I sold cakes. I didn't like had a bakery or had, you know, wasn't like had five cakes on the counter and go, I'm selling cakes. Never did any of that. So I knew I wasn't a salesperson. But what I looked back over the jobs that I had, and I really had to take inventory on what is it do I have to offer? Like, why would somebody want to buy a house from me? And I looked at how we shopped other shopping centers, and I started shopping other realtors. Like, what do they offer their clients? How do they service them? And then how does that client feel after the transaction's done? Do they feel satisfied? Are they frustrated? Is there something that you could have done better? Did you communicate enough? Did you over-communicate? And so once I was leaving GMS Realty, my boss at the time had a friend who I had known that wanted to sell their house. And so I had to tell him, you know, I never sold a house before, so I don't really know, but I'm going with a really small brokerage, and I bet what I think I'm really good at, is I'm going to make sure you feel like you can trust me and that you gave me the opportunity to sell your house so that I can get you the highest amount of money in the shortest amount of time with the least intrusion into your life. Would you be open to that? And she goes, yeah. I said, but I have to bring my broker because I don't know what I'm doing. So can you trust me? And she was like, yeah, man, we put her house up for sale. My broker went with me. We sold that house in 2 days.
Congratulations.
And then I was like, isn't this easy? She goes, it's not usually this easy.
Oh.
I was like, really?
But Kay Bates is involved. That's why.
I'm like, yeah. So maybe it was me then. And she was like, yeah, I think so. And after that, she never had to go to another listing with me or another sale, or you would put me in front of a house. I was determined that if I'm going to do something, first, I'm going to show up for the people. I'm going to make sure that I listen, that I pay attention, I tell the truth, and that I have some kind of credibility. I don't want to be a car salesman. I want you to trust me because my goal is to make sure that I service you to my highest ability. It's not about the money for me. It's not about, you know, how much am I going to get on the end. And there's sometimes I've had deals where I made no money. I mean, I'm serious. The buyer, if I represented, there has been a buyer that I've represented, and she was short $4,000 to bring it into escrow. And I was like, you know what? You can just take the money out of my commission because the client's needs are so much more important than mine. And I think that I'll get rewarded. You'll refer somebody to me, or you might not have to refer somebody to me, but God sees my heart. He understands that I'm here to be of service to others. And that's my main goal, is to give people more than they pay for, to make sure I show up, I pay attention, I tell them the truth, and I remove myself from the outcome, because you don't have to use me. You don't have to work with me. I'll guide you every step of the way. I'll do all that I can. But in the end, you make the decision, because it's your largest asset. It's not mine. And I want you to know that I'm here just to support you. I allow you to make that decision. And the agents who come to work in my office, man, they're like my children, because I really want them to do well, and I'll do anything for them. They just have to be really good people. Yes. I want good people.
Yes, we all want good people. Yeah. You are an exceptionally good person, because the real estate industry is not that, what you just described.
No.
What you just described was a service to people, to build their lives and secure in a secure fashion.
Yeah.
That's a rare situation.
And it's sad because there are a lot of people. I mean, I always ask, well, how did you get my name? I mean, we get called. I just put a rental in Rancho Bernardo, Carmel Mountain. I just put one on yesterday. And these owners, they're people I don't know. They called me and I said, well, how did you get my number and why did you call me? I mean, I want to know. And they said, well, we've called like 5 other people and nobody returned our call. I said, what? They said, yeah, nobody returned our call. And I thought, oh, well, that's really bad. I said, you know, it's our industry is definitely, it's a hit and miss. And I think maybe sometimes some people don't check their phones. He goes, it's been like 4 days. We haven't even gotten a return call. I said, well, I'm not going to tell you I'm the best, but I'm at the best at communicating. I want to make sure, like, you will get an update every day. You will hear from me. If I don't talk to you, you will get an email or a text. And that's what I've done. I mean, I was on a Zoom call with them, their daughter, because she wanted to meet me because she didn't trust the real estate industry. And she said, send me some referrals. So I sent her 3 referrals and I called them. I was like, I didn't even call these people. I just send them the 3 names because there's no need. I'm not prepping them to say anything. They know me. They know my heart. And they called me back and they said, we're just going with you. And I said, you sure? I said, you sure? And he said, yeah, can you meet us? And I said, absolutely. Just tell me when you want to meet, you know? But that's how I work. I'm not trying to, yes, we get paid and people think we are overpaid and the new laws that are in place, people want you to not work for anything. I've had people who call, would you take 1%? I, as much as it's not about the money, I still want to earn a fair wage. I still want to make sure I'm taking care of my business. I mean, I wouldn't ask you, oh, Deanna, I want to get a dozen rolls and can you give it to me for the price of one? Like, why would I do that? That's not fair. And so I handle that, and I always tell them, how do you want somebody to give you their all when you're only willing to pay less than a fraction of what you're willing to ask for? Anybody you go to, if you get what you pay for, right? And sometimes it's really bad. When you pay somebody 1% and they take that, they don't care. There's no heart involved. There's no, I'm going to go all the way out for you. It's like, dude, you only paid me 1%, so that's what you get. Did you read your contract? I'm not giving you any more than that. So it's like, for me, I can't, and it's not because I haven't ever done it. I've done it, but there's no need for me to do that when I'm running a business. You know, I have to take care of business. I have to be smart as well. And I think it's harder for women, I feel, because a lot of people just feel like we're second class still. Like, you know, we shouldn't have to, like, men should make more. And this real estate is a male-dominated field. Regardless of how many women, mostly men own real estate brokerages, you know. And so we still have to fight that whole stereotypical thing. But I make sure, I mean, I stand firm in what I believe, and I'm 10 toes down. I have to make a certain amount, and it's usually competitive. It's not more than anybody else is asking, but I will give you more than you pay for. I have a seller right now. We just put his house in escrow. He's in Spain. You know why he's in Spain? Because he trusts me to do everything. And this guy is the pure example of people wanting, he's like, can I pay you less? And I said, am I going to do like an eighth of the work? Like, what exactly do you want? He goes, well, I want you to sell my house and I want to get the most amount of money. So what's really important to you? Getting the most amount of money. And you want to pay me the least amount of money. Does that make sense? Would you do something like that? And he goes, well, no, when you put it that way, you're embarrassing me. No, you're embarrassing
yourself.
Exactly. You know, because there's no way you want me to give you that service and get you the highest amount of money, but you don't want to pay me. And I left and he kept calling. And I said, no, I'm not going to work for that. And so he gave the listing to another agent who he had a long list of complaints about because she took what he offered. And so he called me after. He goes, okay, I'm licking my wounds, but I'm calling you. He goes, yeah, well, let's do what you said. I said, isn't that weird? You had to endure 6 months of pain before you realized that I would be the person to sell your house. And he goes, don't beat me up too bad. Yeah, it's a good lesson. Mm-hmm. And there are people who I've worked with who, of course, didn't like my style. They didn't want as much hands-on. And I can't help it. So for those people, I'm sorry. But I want to make sure you stay informed. I want to make sure these are documents that people don't read. I want to tell you what you're signing. Most people, they'll get a contract. They just go. They click right through. I send my contracts to people way before in a PDF. Read it. See if you understand it. Let me know what questions you have. Let's go over it before I send it to you, DocuSign. So you know what at least you know what you're signing. So if one of your kids asks, you'd be like, oh yeah, I signed a contract. It's for 6 months and this is how much I have to pay. But not where I send you a contract blindly and you don't know what you've signed. To me, that should be against the law because that's how a lot of seniors are getting ripped off. You know, they sign stuff and they don't know much about it. But that led me to years and years and years of experience. And now I feel unstoppable. And I've had Bates Realty for a very long time, for 8 years. And I enjoy every single success. I've been top 5% San Diego counties since the first time I applied, which was 2015.
Bravo,
and I didn't even
bravo.
Know before then that it was a thing. I was like, oh, it's a thing. They were like, you should apply. And yeah, I've gotten top 5% San Diego County every year since then. And so now what really made me thinking about making a move was the fact that these conglomerates are now buying up these smaller brokerages or they're merging with them. We just had a big merger, Big Block and LPT Realty. They just acquired them. Real is taking over a lot of agents. EXP has come into the market. They've shaked it up. And so I thought, okay, I can remain a boutique brokerage. but I would only do what I do now. I would still do 30 deals. I wouldn't grow because these people have mass dollars that they're advertising with, and, you know, they have billions of dollars of, you know, impressions and everything. Everywhere you turn, you get to see Zillow or, you know, you see Redfin, and I happen to be a Redfin partner agent as well. So they trust me enough, which is crazy. But I actually closed a couple of deals for them. They have their own agents, but they rely on partner agents to do deals where they can't meet those, what the client wants. But I finally just got thinking, I want to be part of something that's bigger than me so I can grow. Because when you're not growing, you're dying. Mm-hmm. And I'm not ready. I'm not ready to die.
Yeah, I think you've proven that already.
I think I have so much more. And I think of women like you that are just, I mean, I look up to you so much. Like, you're a very good example for a woman in the community. Woman, you've had your business for a long, I mean, we drove by your, I'm getting chills. Oh my God. Like, we would drive by your business years and years and years. And I'm like, she's still there in the same spot. So thanks to women like you that I think it has made room for somebody like me to step into those spaces and say, oh my gosh, yeah, I could be a badass. I could be a boss.
You are a badass. So. You are a boss.
Well, because of people like you.
Thank you.
Because you've made space for women like me. And I really appreciate that. I think without your leadership, that's why I was so excited for you to be chair. I think we needed like a strong woman presence and to see what women can do. And you've turned this thing around, and I mean,
oh my gosh, I'm getting chills too.
Yeah, we are on a total different trajectory than where we were going. Yeah.
We are.
And regardless of what naysayers had to say, you know, I mean, you're so strong. And I think that's really what I lean on is the fact that you're gifted, you're strong, you're empowering because of how you treat us. You are empowering. You don't just accept all of it. You're like, no, you're great and you're great and you're great, which is a great tool of a leader. You know, not just to be the person who's collecting all the accolades, but be the person who, you know, wants to share it all with everyone.
Yeah. We're a great team. Yeah. And that's what it takes, a great team and great team players.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have so much more to tell, but this is probably more than enough. Like my journey from Trinidad to here to this.
Well, we can definitely do a part two.
Definitely. Yeah. I'll be open to that.
If you're ready.
Yep.
Yeah, there's so much more about Kay Bates that I can't wait for everyone to hear.
Yeah, stuff not to do, stuff to, like I said, I have done so much stuff. And just by the grace of God, I have not, I mean, I've been in businesses where it just didn't work, mm-hmm. but not lost things, you know, not lose my pants or, you know, it just shifted. But also mindset has a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm. You know, how so? Tell me more about that.
Oh, the first thing, I mean, I was a huge Tony Robbins fan, mm-hmm. like huge, like, oh my God, my kids hated me. We have to listen to Tony Robbins in the morning on the way to, we lived in Hidden Meadows in South Escondido. So anywhere they went to school, we had to drive. I would pop in a Tony Robbins CD, lift your arms up over your head because you can't help but smile if your arms are up over your head. And they're like, what the hell is wrong with you? You have to have a morning routine. You have to have something you believe in. You have to know that you are the best at whatever you do. Well, there's Johnny and he's way better. No, Johnny's not better than you. Johnny thinks he's better than you. But if you start believing that you're the best, you're the only person that could do this, you're going to. I mean, we tell ourselves stuff, and if you tell yourself you can't, you can't. But if you tell yourself you can, you can. And so that was part of Tony Robbins helped me create a morning routine. I journal, so I do three journals. And I journal because, like I said earlier, I'm really an introvert. And because instead of being confrontational with people or having to express certain things to a person, I'd rather put it in words and have them to myself. So then mm-hmm. I can reflect on it. And what did I do? How did I handle it? What was the outcome? And for me, it's more beneficial. So I do that. I do a gratefulness journal. And then I do a journal of, you know, what I would like the world to be like. Kind and gentle and open to all people and, you know, people from everywhere, because I'm from a different place and I'm here, you know. Mm-hmm. So those are the journals that I write. But in the morning, I do make sure, like, I pray, I meditate, I before I set my foot on the ground, I want to make sure that I have good intentions for the day. Mm-hmm. And staying positive is a huge part of it, because you can jump in your car, and we take it for granted. We just jump in our car and our car is going to go. And before you get out to the first stoplight, somebody can cut you off. There's an accident waiting to happen. There's so many things that can change your day into a negative day. And that when there are people waiting to pass me, I'm like, go for it. I don't have to be anywhere in a rush. I take my time because I'll give myself an hour to get anywhere I'm going. So you want to go, maybe you're first in line to be in that coffin. It won't be me today, but it'll be you. Mm-hmm. So I just never, or I should say I minimize the amount of stress by just starting my morning believing that the day's going to be great. It's a good day to be alive. It's a good day to be interacting with other people. Look at the amazing people God has put in my life today. I mean, how can I make this day any better? What can I do? How can I help somebody today? Who can I help today? And that's, I think, what I do to get my mindset right. So I'm not playing a victim. If I didn't find somebody, sometimes I would just go to the dollar store when the 99-cent store was open, pay for the person behind me. And it doesn't matter. It could be $5. It could be $20. It could be $1. Mm-hmm. But just putting a smile on somebody else's face, because I think everybody has something that they could be going through. Some of us might be more traumatic than others that nobody knows about. And why would you want to cuss somebody out or tell somebody off or call somebody a name or, you know, because they don't look like you or they don't love like you? Mm-hmm. To me, it's just awful.
And you're so not awful.
Yeah, I try. I work really hard on being not awful. Because I think, like I said, there's too many people going through so many things. And we don't know.
We don't know. We can't judge.
You can't. So instead, I walk around. I give hugs. Like this morning, that's every Wednesday morning, I'm in Carlsbad. And so, yeah, I walk around. It's a room full of realtors and loan officers, title people. And I walk around. I give hugs because that's like me sharing my personal space, you know. And I'm like, come give me. Because it doesn't just make you feel better. It makes me feel better, too. Sure. You know, I could be having one of those mornings. But thank God I'm not. Thank God I'm on the other side of my illness, and I feel great, and I am as happy as I can be.
Yes. So in part two, we'll talk about, you mentioned a little bit about an illness and how you have conquered, overcome, and then that big step that you just took.
Yes, we can talk about that in part two. Thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for being here, and I can't wait.